Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 4th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Agriculture in the Global Economy, Session 1 of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality, Some New Visions for the Future of God's Earth and God's People. Week 2 presented by Jim Bowman, number BOJ 2003-06. Let's listen in.
It's important for you to know that so that you're aware that you are being recorded, not that you're likely to say something in this session that you would be embarrassed about. But in either case, I had to sign my name agreeing to be recorded, so we're not asking you to sign your name. I work for the I'm director of the Office of Public Policy for Lutheran World Relief in Washington, D.C. And I don't think I need to talk about the organization. You're familiar with it. It's a relief and development organization that gets funding from both the ELCA, which I assume that most of you represent, probably not all of you, but we also get funding from the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. And we have a presence in about 50 different countries throughout the world. In our public policy work, we try to respond to the concerns that come to us from our partners in certainly not all those 50 countries, but in many of them. And what I'm doing here last week and now this second week is talk about some of those areas of policy concerns that we are confronting as we are working with especially poor people who live in poor countries throughout the world. Today we're going to be talking about agriculture, and I guess I'd like to see the hands of anyone in here who are making their living from agriculture. Whose primary income is at the present time in agriculture, or all right? A few, a couple. How many have relatives who are involved in agriculture of some kind? A few more hands go up. All right. Assuming that most of you are from the United States, that's not unusual. That not very many of you would be directly involved in agriculture. If I were sitting in most countries in Sub-Saharan Africa today and asked that question of a similar group, about 80% of you would be raising your hands as if it were a representative group. So we'll talk about some of those differences and what it means. I guess I always think of myself as having agriculture roots because my father was kind of a poor pastor who always supplemented his income by having huge gardens wherever we went. And we kids always felt sorry for ourselves because we had to work in those gardens. All the other kids were playing ball and doing other fun things in the summertime. And then we peddled those things house to house in the surrounding cities. So that's how we survived. And so in many ways, that's the kind of agriculture that a lot of people in this world are involved with. I didn't realize that when I was growing up. I thought we were just kind of poor preacher's kids. But anyway, and then I married into an agriculture family. Moved from Minnesota to Nebraska and sat down in band next to my future wife when I was 15 years old. Took a long time before I got around to marrying her. Her family was involved in a heavily corporate family farm that has been passed on from her grandfather, who immigrated from Sweden and who got 160 acres of that homestead land near the railroads as they went out west, and two brothers that came here, and one had 14 children by two wives, not at the same time, but in sequence. And the second brother had 16 children from one wife. So the Pye family are sort of just spread out all over, sort of owned the whole county there, or almost, it seemed like. and continue to be involved in a much different kind of agriculture today than they were when they came literally on covered wagons in the late 1800s. As far as agriculture globally, and we're going to be talking about sort of some, even though we'll be talking about some specific areas here, when we think of agriculture globally, there have been some tremendous changes that have taken place, and it's part of the, in some ways, it's part of the good news. It's part of what's been, we usually, hear these stories about famine and people hungry, and we'll be getting to that. But when you look at the amount of food that has been produced globally over the years, in the last 30 years, between 1969 and 1999, the amount of food that has been produced globally has actually increased from about in 1969 about 2,000 equivalent of, this is the measurement that we're going to use for this purpose of this statistic, about 2,140 calories per person per day to 1999, about 2,800 calories per person per day. So the amount of food, or at least the caloric value of the food that has been produced, has actually increased. And that's not insignificant when you also realize that in the last 40 years, the world's population has doubled. The world's population has doubled. So we're not just simply taking a snapshot of, X number of people in the world here and using that same figure for this year. We're looking at an incredible doubling of the population, and in order for that to happen, a lot of things, of course, have had to happen as well. But I think it's a tribute to the farmers of the world and the kind of work that they do and have had to do on a regular basis. But that's just the good news, I guess. The fact that and what we also need to point out is these figures at 2,800 calories per person per day is actually enough food. It's enough food for everybody in the world. There's no shortage. There's no shortage of food in terms of the people. But there are places of what we call food insecurity. And that has actually, while food production has gone up, there are certain regions of the world that have actually had an increase in what we call food insecurity. And those areas would be North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, parts of Asia, and the Middle East as well. Especially during the last 10 years or the last decade of the 20th century. What's ironic is that in about this same time period, in the last 10 years, the rate of overweight Americans has increased by 61%, so that we now have over half the population in this country as, now I, don't ask me I look at myself and am I part of that, am I that part of that 51%, or am I part of 49? I don't know. The statistics are gathered by the U.S. Health and Human Services, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. There's been quite a bit of attention being given to that whole issue of what it means to be overweight in the U.S. We do know that there are 33 million Americans who are living at risk of hunger today, so it isn't as though everybody is living well, even here in the U.S. Some other global figures that I think are important for us, because when we think of hunger, it's important to think of the welfare of children. Children under five, these are statistics now that have been gathered by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. 200 million children under five have what's called stunted growth because of malnutrition, because of nutrition issues. 150 million are underweight. This is on top of that 200 million. Another 50 million are seriously underweight. The term that they use in their report for seriously underweight as opposed to underweight is the term wasting, which is a sort of a pretty graphic word to talk about this, especially as it relates to children. And 6 million children die each year, children under the age of five, die each year of hunger-related diseases. Most of that is diarrhea. Now, if we were to look or take a picture of the world's poorest one category of the world's poor is those who earn less than $1 a day. Those are sort of the poorest of the poor. I mean, then there's the category of those who earn less than $2 a day. But in the category of the world's 1.2 billion people who earn less than $1 a day, 3/4 of them are farmers who live in obviously rural areas, making a living from agriculture or ag-related activities. So the question arises out of this, if you have enough food being produced in the world today, and yet you have these fairly large pockets of poverty and children going hungry, why is there still hunger? Maybe we could just open that up for a few minutes and talk about it. What would be some of the let me start off by putting it. Is there a ratio?
You drop on the floor.
Oh, here. Okay, thank you. This oversimplistic answer, of course, is why is there hunger? Well, either people don't have food. I mean, that's obvious. If they don't have food, they're going to be hungry. But even if there is food available, people can't buy it. Let's say, assuming the food can't buy food, and it's basically we're talking about poverty here. Food might be available, but they don't have the money to buy it. So given that kind of framework, now let's take the conversation a little bit further and talk about what are some of the reasons for other reasons beyond this that there is hunger. And we won't go into, I just want to sort of list them without going into a lot of details.
Distribution.
What?
Distribution.
Okay, when you're talking about distribution. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, I'm familiar with Madagascar.
Yeah.
Sometimes up north they have grape crops and fruit and vegetables and meat also. But down south they have famine.
Mm-hmm.
There's no infrastructure that's sensible that will bring the fruit from the north, food from the north to the south.
Okay. Let's add that. I'd like to add that word. Infrastructure, because it's tied obviously with distribution,
mm-hmm.
but distribution sometimes can also refer to just sort of other kind of inequities that might be
economic.
But infrastructure is very much a part of that. Roads to get
trucks
to get their goods to market.
Yeah,
and so that's a very, very big part of the problem of hunger, especially in poor and developing countries. That's one of the reasons why one of the things that the World Bank and the World Bank has done over the period of years has gone into countries and tried to make and IMF too, loans for roads and ways of getting goods to market. So that's okay. We've got to start. Some other reasons for hunger. Yes.
Waste.
Waste in what? In what kind of? What are you talking about there? People are just throwing food away carelessly. That isn't what you mean, I'm sure, but maybe part of it.
Well, it looked, you know, in your diagram, there was enough food to feed everyone. So if there are some people who aren't getting it, then there are either it's not being used or some people are over-consuming. Mm-hmm. Seem to me to be the two places that could go. So if it's not being used, it's being wasted.
Also lack of storage.
Okay, and yeah, waste covers a lot of things here. And when you either lack of storage or poor storage facilities, that adds to the waste. When you look at where food is grown, you know, when it's harvested in the field, to the time that it's actually sold in the marketplace, there's several. Of course, if it's grown in the field and consumed, there's probably not a lot of waste. But I mean, there's waste in terms of if it's a grain that has to be
processed.
Right. There's loss in that. There's loss in storage. A lot of steps along the way that you lose things. Okay, good. Back there.
Yeah, local depletion of resources. For instance, you could have soils deplete to where you're no longer getting.
As far as agriculture in Africa, that's one of the real serious problems. I'm more familiar with Africa because I lived there. I lived in Liberia for 3 years, a long time ago, back in the late 60s. But depletion of soil and farming it year after year, not having access to fertilizers and things to replenish poor soil.
Well, it's just a calculation.
Lack of water.
Lack of water. Water is just really.
Or too much water.
Or too much water in some cases.
Droughts
and floods. I mean, it all has to do with water. Water, and we'll just assume that it's both too much or too little, or not at the right time. Yeah.
Wars.
Okay. War and conflict.
Yeah.
One out of five Africans live in countries where there are conflicts of some kind. I mean, violent conflicts of some kind. And that, obviously, and that's part of the reason I just included these little things here. We, Lutheran World Relief, has just reprinted these. You know, we're still are one of those countries that haven't signed the landmine the treaty. And there are Angola, there are lots of places in Africa where you can't farm because there are still buried landmines. When I went back to Liberia in 97 to be an election observer and went to the part of the country where Charles Taylor's troops had been and met with the unarmed United Nations officers, they told us which roads we should not be traveling on to go check at the election places because they'd been mined. So that had nothing to do with food, but it had to do with our ability to determine whether or not an election was supposedly fair or unfair. Back there.
What about high-protein diet, animal protein diet?
Okay, can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, if you're feeding the grain that could go to humans to animals, the conversion of that food that could feed people to animals is not efficient.
Okay.
High cost of transporting food from where it's grown to where it's needed.
Okay, the transportation costs. Some of these we may come back to, so transportation costs. What's interesting here on transportation costs is the transportation costs are usually connected to poor countries which don't have the infrastructure we're talking about. When you look at transportation costs of transporting food from developing countries to from the what I call the south to the north. If I use those, are those terms familiar to you? I don't want to use language here. When I use the word south, I'm talking about the global south now, or what's usually thought of as the developing countries as opposed to the global north, I just want to make sure that I don't use language that you're not familiar with. But in transporting the food from the global south to the global north, transportation costs have actually been a real, well, let me just say this, transportation costs, shipping and air transportation have lowered incredibly over the years. So the transportation cost in terms of getting food from the south to the north has actually increased the flow of food in that direction, but of course it has contributed to the poverty in the other direction, so it's still, it's complicated, but I just wanted to mention that. And over here?
transition to cash cropping and monoculture.
Okay. We'll certainly come back to this. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that for those who may not know what you're talking about?
Well, when there are incentives for farmers to switch to crops that can be sold in the global marketplace rather than the traditional array of crops, so if you're only growing one crop and there's a drought or too much rain, you can run into serious trouble. Whereas if you're growing multiple crops, usually if one does bad, then another one might still be okay and you won't starve.
Right.
Meanwhile, something like cotton, a cash crop, you can't eat that, period.
Right. You can grow a lot of cotton, if that's the only thing that survives, you can't eat cotton.
Yeah. Right.
Just to fill in, because I want to keep moving here.
There's one more that...
I'm sorry.
I was going to say cultural and lifestyles make a lot of difference, especially for children. I think culture... for instance, I also live in Liberia, by the way. But I do know that, often the men were able to eat first and they could eat the best of the rice and the meat and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And then the women got to have it and the children got what was ever left over often.
Mm-hmm.
And that also contributed then to malnutrition for children. Or in the United States, the lack of proper nutrition, like just feeding them lots and lots of chips and, they may have some food, but they're not trained on what's nutritious.
Yeah. We could spend probably a whole session talking about the dynamics of food in this country, and that would be interesting, and it's actually included in a sidebar in this, and this is just a little commercial for this publication, and I'm glad you mentioned it because it's triggered some other things. The Bread for the World Institute, all of you have probably heard of Bread for the World, the offering of letters that they do every year. Every year their institute produces one of the best reports on world hunger. And the one this year, the most recent one for 2003, is called Agriculture and the Global Economy. I only had one copy of this to bring to show you, but if any of you are interested in getting copies of this, I'd be glad to send it to you. If you talk to me afterwards, I'll give you our email address, or you can just contact www.lwr.org/advocacy, and you can get it's on that. So
what month did that come out?
This is embargoed until April 2nd. I got this before it was released, so this was released just this April, so it's fairly recent. It's the most recent, we have boxes of them down in Baltimore because LWR does is we help pay for the publishing. That's one of the things that LWR does is contribute to the publishing of this. So we So we don't just make it available to everybody because it's a fairly costly publication, but we're glad to send it to those who want it. Let me just briefly talk about a couple of other things that we didn't mention, and that is there's also hunger because of discrimination, and I'm talking primarily now about indigenous people. In certain parts of the world where there are people who, for one reason or another, and it gets into the various cultures, are discriminated against, and for that reason, food is not available to them. I just wanted to fill out the list here of what I had down. We also didn't mention the effect of disease, and especially in Africa, the impact of HIV/AIDS. We're talking about countries in Africa where a very high percentage, and we'll get more probably into this on Wednesday, for those of you who want to or choose to come here to talk about the HIV/AIDS crisis. And but what has happened there, and the people who are the, and we'll get into that in a little bit here too, the people who are the real backbone farming in Africa are women and the age group overall between say 19 and 35 or 36. Well, when you lose those people to HIV/AIDS, as many African countries are, who's going to plant the crops? Who's going to harvest the crops? You're losing your farm labor. And it's and so, you, I. This fly is just attacking me. I got it.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's another, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. What do rural people need all over the world
to
grow food? Well, they need. Decent soil. There's a lot of marginal land that's being used, and we'll talk about some of the reasons for that. And also, they need access to water. But even more important, they need access to land. And that's an issue. And land is used and owned differently in different parts of the world. I mean, you've read about the struggles in different parts. Some African countries have actually, taken over some of the large estates. I think this may have been done in Kenya. You can correct me if I'm wrong on this. We have an African sort of expert with us today. Well, we just assume she's an expert because she's from Tanzania. But Tanzania and Kenya did things very differently at the time of independence. They took large estates in Kenya, broke up that land, distributed it to smaller farmers. In Tanzania, at least at the time Julius Nyerere became the first president in the early 60s, it was an experiment in a process of sort of socialism where people owned land individually but jointly, and that experiment did not work out very well, and that's been abandoned since then. In Colombia, he must have been resurrected here, or else he's got relatives. In Colombia, land, some of the best land, is owned by very wealthy people, and they're large estates owned by wealthy people. A certain state of Colombia that is almost 100% Afro-Colombian and rural, as well as some indigenous people, the land is held in common. It's more like many African countries where I was in Liberia, people, the land was sort of given to people and passed on into, never quite figured out how it worked. You know, if you married into that village, you know, they sort of gave you some land to use. And then, of course, it was complicated in Liberia between the land that was sort of under the control of the missions that were there. But anyway, aside from that, access to land is very important, and land reform in many countries is going to be critical before any kind of equity is going to take place or happen. The other thing is that agriculture, in terms of overall development assistance given by the industrialized North to developing countries, only 12% of that assistance is designated for, even though so much of the developing world consists and its needs consist of agriculture-related activities, only 12% of that aid goes for rural agriculture-related projects. And the developing countries themselves spend less than 4% of their expenditures on agriculture. So not much money is, not much assistance is coming at that level, either from the global north or from the countries themselves. I'd like to just switch gears a little bit and talk about the women's role in agriculture, especially in Africa. And don't hesitate to tell me if I'm misleading people or if you have something to add, just jump right in, Krista. In Africa, women farmers are responsible for 80 to 90% of the domestic food crops, and yet they are among the disproportionately poor. If you took the category of poor people in Africa, 70% of them are women. So how can it be that even though women are primarily responsible for the production of food that is consumed in the household, why are they disproportionately poor? You can maybe open that up for discussion. Maybe you've heard about what?
Culture.
And
tradition.
What about
marketing?
Can you let's get back to that. By culture, what do you mean here? What?
It's always been done that way.
It's always been done that way, right? Well, I mean, it's okay. Women have, yes. When we talk about women involved in food production in developing countries, that's pretty much true globally. Africa isn't unique in that regard. But it is true that part of the culture is that women are doing this kind of work, the household work. They're birthing, they're taking care of those children. A study was done in Tanzania some time ago and about the number of hours that women work in a day and just doing the household and agricultural work, and it's between 14 and 16 hours a day. Is that an exaggeration, do you think?
Not really exaggeration. Anyway, what you're saying is true, because women work more hours than men. They spend most of the time in agriculture, looking after their children.
Yeah.
And whatever work, like, fetching maybe it's a poor food, like food, water, and so forth. You're saying that poor is because actually whether you produce, you are not the one who's going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
It's the man who's going to sell, the husband. Because it's not for you as a woman, it's for the family.
Right.
And the head of the family is the one who is allowed to go and sell.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even if you go sell, maybe if the market is not, it's not there, you can go with your cross to the open market, you don't sell, and then you come back with it, or just leave it there because you have to carry it on your head,
mm-hmm.
go back with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
But you can spend it for one week.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, most of the women, they don't involve themselves in their. Some of the tribes they do, but some of the tribes they don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You go to work, you come back, it's just sitting on the table, drinking,
mm-hmm.
and doing awesome.
Yeah. I'm in Nebraska, our companion synod was the Northern Diocese in Tanzania, and I was on the staff of the Nebraska Synod, worked with that. And one of the complaints I heard from a lot of women, Tanzanian women, as I went there, is that, and you could see it as you drove down the villages or the streets, there are many in many urban areas in Moshi, the men were sitting there during the day, drinking this beer, whatever that beer is. Reading the newspaper, drinking the beer. The women were out doing the work. The men, and that's part of the culture you're talking about here. And the other piece of that was that and again, these are generalizations. The men also, if there was a cash crop, you know, they maybe had more. They had more access to the cash crop. You know, if it was cocoa in Ghana or coffee or something else, that was their area, and the women worked more on growing the products that were actually consumed in the home. There's another problem that African countries are beginning to deal with. This is that women have no inheritance rights, so they lose their husband. They don't have access to the land. The land goes back to the husband's family, and that's another. I mean, it's all part of this. I mean, you use the one word culture. It covers a lot of things here, but I mean that specifically is another kind of process which limits their access to land and if they have no, also women tend to be less educated in general. And when you are less educated, you also don't have the kind of technical training and access to credit and other things.
What about the availability and distribution of the good land, as far as the land being used by either European settlers or transnational companies, displacing the local production onto the marginal land?
I just moved this over here from page 5 to page 6, and it says trade liberalization and women farmers. So you've done the segue, the question that I was coming up to next. So thank you for moving us in that direction. Let's talk about that. We talked about it a little bit last Saturday. For some of you who were here last Saturday, we were talking about trade in broader ways. But what's happened over the past several years, since about 94, I guess, where there has been a lot of pressure from international financial institutions, the WTO, World Trade Organization, for developing countries in order to get out of the hole that many of them find themselves in, global debt, they have to generate exports that can generate the dollars to pay for their debt. So they're encouraged to grow crops, encouraged to do a lot of other things in terms of natural resources, but our focus is here on agriculture now. They're encouraged to grow crops that can be sold on the international and traded on the international market that bring in dollars. So what happens then? What happens is what was mentioned up here, and you're really in the dark up there. I didn't know where that voice was coming from. So what happens is that the good land, then, that can produce these crops is used for that purpose, and the marginal land, not only is marginal land increasingly used for domestic food production, but it also becomes smaller in size. And as if that weren't enough, because of the agricultural policies in the U.S., Japan, and Europe, where agriculture is heavily subsidized and the price is heavily supported, a lot of those crops are now being exported to the developing countries and compete with the food that they've been producing, and it becomes ironic. In Guyana, In Guyana, for example, you know where Guyana is? Northern coast of Latin America. You know. They no longer can compete with processed fruit juices that come from France and Thailand. I mean, that has to do with lower transportation costs, for one thing, but also subsidized programs in those countries. And so they stop growing these things. And over a period of years, the skill is lost in how to do that and do it well. And so you have these tremendous imbalances and inequities that happens when, and then of course, as women whose responsibility has been to grow these food for their household, and that land is reduced, and the demand for food is always there, it doesn't go away. Many times on these large, more industrial type agriculture estates that are created, they then hire themselves out as seasonal farm workers to work in those fields or to work in the processing plants to process that food. So they lose access and control to their own land, and they become slaves, is what it amounts to. And they no longer have, if that company decides tomorrow that it's cheaper to go someplace else, they'll do that, and they have done that in the past. So that's what's created some of the terrific. Now, it doesn't always work that way. Let me read to you one example where it didn't work that way, and this is in Ghana, where, let me see if I can read this. Okay. When credit and other support is available for growing cash crops, some women farmers have benefited from trade liberalization. It's not Kenya. It's not Ghana. It's Kenya. In Kenya, women farmers who own small plots of land have succeeded in exporting green beans to Europe and other regions. The profit margin on green beans is high. Most importantly for women, green beans can be grown on a family farm, which provides women the flexibility to care for their families while cultivating cash crops. In addition, green beans require specialized skills that women already possess from growing their family garden crops. But that's a very small example. It's not the usual thing, but it's an example where it does work, where it doesn't displace them. It's a skill that they already have. They know how to grow beans. I actually saw an area in Kenya when I was there in 94 that Lutheran World Relief had. It was actually an irrigation project where a small stream was diverted to bring some water to this village, and they were growing these beans for export. The only thing I was uncomfortable about was, of course, the company that provided them the seeds to grow these beans were also very liberally supplying them with pesticides and herbicides to increase the production of those beans, but without much direction on how to apply them safely. And here they were handling this stuff, bare hands, no masks. It was, now, let me talk about another example of this. What country would you guess is the second largest source of flour exports in the world? I don't know what the first is. It could be Tanzania. They grow an awful lot of flowers. But the second one, do you know what that is?
Ecuador.
It's a surprise to me.
Is it Ecuador?
Table flowers or flour for bread?
Table flowers. Yeah, right. Table flowers. I'm sorry. Flowers for table flowers.
Kenya.
You're getting close with Ecuador. I'll give you that clue.
Peru.
Chile.
Do you know that one out of every two flowers in the United States that are sold come from Colombia. And 80,000 women work in the greenhouses in Colombia to produce those.
Would poppies be among those?
Well, Colombia is, that is one of the products. It's, I assume that you were saying that facetiously.
Yes, I was.
Poppies
and coconut in Colombia.
But the problem there is that even though Colombia has some pretty good rules on the books regarding safety standards for working in those conditions, those standards are not enforced very well. So, another area of unevenness or of injustice, really, when it comes to global trade in the agriculture area, is the inability of, because of our trade policies, for developing countries to, it's just a very uneven playing field. Two, if farmers are displaced in these countries for one reason or another, or they experience hardship, the government does not have the resources to provide subsidies to those farmers to keep them going. And yet that is what our country has been doing for many, many years. Our country, meaning both U.S., Japan, and again the European Union. There's several things. We put up trade barriers or tariffs in our country to protect our markets. Last Saturday we talked about the most recent example of that, protecting our 13,000 catfish farmers in the south at the expense of a million people in Vietnam who are trying to get into the catfish business. We just made that decision was just made a couple of weeks ago. And so even though we talk a good line about liberalizing trade and talk about free trade, it just ain't so. It's very hypocritical, in my opinion. The U.S. criticizes Europe for their subsidies, and Europe criticizes us for our subsidies, and they both say, well, if you stop, we'll stop, but nobody stops doing that. And it's not an easy thing, because if you talk to farmers in this country who are struggling, how do you answer their questions? Unfortunately, much of the subsidy in this country doesn't get to the poor farmers in our own country. It just isn't. I know that because I have nephews involved in this and brother-in-laws involved in this, and I know the kinds of, and they don't like it themselves, but they aren't sending those checks back to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Yes?
What percentage of American agriculture is corporate agriculture versus small?
Well, when you say corporate, I mean, are you talking about corporate ownership of land?
Yeah.
I don't know. Does anybody know that? I mean, I can talk about the extent to which large, what's become now transnational companies, are sort of, there's just a handful of them that are controlled, even though they may not own the land. They sell the seed and the fertilizers and the chemicals, and they buy the products, and they market those products, and so they're involved in it sort of from beginning to end. They may not own the land, but they're heavily involved in the whole production of crops and food. So, but I don't know what, I know that, I mean, I do know that the trend in the United States is for in the 60s and 70s, farmers, I mean, they've been struggling for a long time, but I mean, that's in my own most recent memory. Farmers in rural America were really struggling. They were losing their land, lands, and they were sales were going on all the time in the Midwest, in Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and the farms where I came from in Nebraska were all getting much bigger, and people were being pushed out. Children of farmers just couldn't, they had to go, had to leave the community and find other work, unless they were willing to be just hired hands on some of these farms. And part of that, of course, is the impact of scale of farming and the margin involved in farming. What a farmer gets for a bushel of wheat today is very little different from what his grandfather got for a bushel of wheat. And the other thing is that marketing has an added layer of cost to these products, so that you have the farmer, on the average, and of course it depends on what crop we're talking about, the farmer gets about 20% of the dollar of a dollar in terms of, I know that isn't true in the case of, it's even less for a loaf of bread that's sold in the area of wheat, but on the average, it gets very, you know, there's the transportation, there's the processing, there's the packaging, and then there's the creating the need, the what do you call it,
advertising.
All those costs have gone on to that. Now there are. I'm sorry. It's the time is just going so fast. I'm stopping myself mid sentence here, but it seems to me that we need to think a little more creatively and more, or raise more questions about how, what the impact is of our, and you know, this is the difficulty, because there's so little that we know about how things actually work in our own country and its impact on, I wish that I could take my brother-in-law and my nephew to Tanzania to sit down and talk with farmers there. I think they would come back and they would, because they're not people, they're caring people. They're people who are concerned about issues like this, but they don't have the opportunity to get involved with these issues and think about how things need to be changed. We tried that. We tried to get rid of the subsidies a number of years ago in this country, and it didn't work. They came back. And that's interesting, because the people who are pushing the subsidies are not just the number of farmers in this country proportionally is very small if you talk about numbers, but they represent a lot of powerful special interests, and it's the transnational companies who are also behind that, because their profits are based on that as well. The people are involved in large agriculture. I mean, their lobbyists are some of the best money can buy, and they do a very effective job in protecting those kinds of concerns. And it's hard to give that up, because I think that the responsible way to do it is not just simply to just get rid of those subsidies. There has to be some kind of a transition process so that people are protected along the way and they're just not left hanging out there. There's a question.
I was wondering, if we got rid of subsidies, though, then that would open up the market for even more globalization and even more more transportation of food for huge for very long distances. And I'm wondering if maybe it would be a better solution to foster more community and more farmers in the U.S. growing food for their specific community, and less transportation over huge distances of food. And then in Africa and in other developing countries, of going back to growing food for their specific community rather than the cash cropping. And I actually think subsidies might be a solution, in a sense, to stopping globalization on such an extreme level.
The system that we have now encourages surpluses.
Yeah.
And then we dump those surpluses.
Right.
We have to get rid of them. We got all this food, so we have to dump it someplace.
Yeah.
And so we said, and there are things that you can do. I mean, I'm sort of proud of my, I have two daughters, one lives in Albuquerque, and she has two children, she just arrived today, but about early this spring, they joined a local, they pay, I don't know what it is, $300 a year or something like that, and every week they go out and they work in this garden and they get whatever's growing that week and they take it home. I mean, it's just kind of wonderful. I read about this also in the Lutheran magazine some time ago. There have been experiments like this. This is one way that farmers are trying to, you know, they charge people a fee to sort of, it's a little bit of a cooperative. They own the land, they control everything, but the people come in and...
CSOs,
yeah,
community
supported
agriculture.
CSA, where you get subscriptions, whether or not you actually work on the farm.
Yeah, right, there's different levels of agreements that are made, but it is one example where people feel more empowered by doing that, you know? I was so sick of planting potatoes and hoeing corn when I was a kid that I don't know if I'd be too anxious to do that again. But you know, I think it's difficult. You see, it's more the people who usually take advantage of that are the more affluent people who are educated, who understand these things. And this is another issue about the overweight people in the U.S. They're not affluent people. They're many of them are poor people, but they don't have access to those markets. The good, the more nutritious food isn't sold in grocery stores near them. They're sold in the Whole Foods stores that people can get to.
And it's more expensive.
And it's
because
more expensive.
Because of the over surplus of corn and wheat.
Yeah.
All of the things that are less expensive are the just corn and wheat, basically white stuff.
Yeah.
We're
supposed to stop at 4:15, aren't we?
The best solution in the Twin Cities has been the farmers markets.
Mm-hmm.
Minneapolis and St. Paul both now are increasing the size, building shelters over them and so forth. And people come from western Wisconsin and all over Minnesota to these farmers markets, and they move around town. So that on Saturdays it's the big deal downtown, but we also have them in churchyards and other locations during the week. And people all in Minnesota, that is cheap.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely almost criminally cheap, I think, sometimes. The Hmong people who have come into Minnesota in a very big way are extremely good gardeners. And they are represented very heavily in these markets and have found themselves able to gather capital and move on into more entrepreneurship by coming into these Saturday and other daily markets. So that's the best solution we have where we are.
Let me tell you one thing that I attempted to do. It was somewhat successful, and probably in the end not very successful. And when we lived in Lincoln, Nebraska for a number of years, and we went to a very large Lutheran church, one of the biggest Lutheran churches. And I was involved in all, you know, alternative kinds of energy and everything else at the time. But I was upset that so much of that land of the church, you know, the lawn, you know, they just poured chemicals in it to get that grass to grow. And I said, why don't we just dig it up and plant a garden, a church garden? Well, boy, I tell you, getting the church council to agree to that took several years. And finally said, well, you can take a little parcel of it, you know. So we did a small, and it was so exciting because people would then come and they would work in there on Saturday, you know, and we would grow things that were simple and easy, you know, cucumbers and tomatoes and melons, and then we harvested what was there and took it down to the shelters and the food pantries in town, and the kids got involved with it. Everybody got excited about it. It went well for a number of years until, you know, what happened? They paved it over and made a bigger parking lot.
Our church has a very similar project and a very similar conflict of pressure.
So we aren't thinking very creatively. I think there's so many more things that we could be doing, not only personally in our own lives, to try to address this, but also in our more corporate community lives, in our churches, denomination, and, you know, in the communities in which we live. So
in our churches, particularly. I'm from Eastern Washington Iowa Synod, and our theme of the assembly last year was rural. We assigned partner churches of rural churches with city churches, which is an education process.
Yeah.
So many people in the city don't know where their peas and lentils and all the food that comes from. And I think that's a step which churches can do in working together and educating each other about where our food comes from.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time, and I can't believe that all of you came here at this time of the day. This is just the most mar- If you were here last week, you know how hiking was just awful, and the weather's now cooled off, and it's just... So I'm just very grateful that you all showed this interest. Thank you for being here, and I hope some of you come back on the week.